Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. We are honored today to have as our guest is Diane Johnson, one of the world's foremost women of letters, who has written a trilogy of brilliant novels that take place. And as I was talking to her yesterday, I'm going to have her pronounce the titles so that I don't mangle the words.
Le divorce, le mariage, the marriage, and l'affaire.
I would have gotten number one and number three right, but I would have stumbled on number two.
Mariage is the only tricky one.
Yes. Yeah. And for those of you who have not had the pleasure of reading this, is it okay if I refer to it as a trilogy?
I guess it is a trilogy, yeah, even though the characters are not the same.
And that's one of the things I'd like to talk about. Was okay. It probably would have been easier to maintain the same characters through the three novels. So let's talk first about Le Divorce, which, as I mentioned in the introduction, was nominated for the National Book Award when it was published and was made into what I consider a very entertaining film. We talked yesterday. I thought Naomi Watts was extraordinary in her role. And that was the first in the series, and it was almost as if you were prescient at the time that things would become so interesting between the French and the Americans during the writing of these three novels, and particularly in L'Affaire, there's an avalanche that's caused, and when you began writing it, this was prior to really the outbreak between the French and the United States over airspace and that type of thing. So let's start with Le Divorce. And talk a bit about the characters in there, and when you started this, if you envisioned having three novels that would emerge from.
I didn't really envision three, or I didn't feel like I needed to set a limit. I've always just written my novels about where I am, the things I see around me, and so on. And circumstance took me to live in Paris in about 95. My husband got a job there, and so I found myself living in Paris, and Le Divorce, the reactions of a newcomer to that society are pretty much my reactions. I noticed that all the women were wearing scarves, and I was petrified to speak French, even though I, of course, had some in school. It's quite different to speak it and understand it, I found, and so I had a year of shyness where I wasn't willing to say anything. And pretty much I had the experiences that all Americans do who go to live in another society, try to feel their way along. Some aspects of culture shock and other things that I learned to admire a lot in France. The food is just the obvious one, the clothes, all the nice things, the excellent way that they've organized their society for human comfort and amusement. So,
but the role of the automobile is much less prevalent in...
Yes, which I must say is a joy. It's turned me into a rabid anti-car person, even though I sort of like cars, and I've even written about them for the New York Times and so on. Now I see that the car just robs us of hours every day, and it's a joy to walk along on your feet, and you see things in an entirely different way.
And we're at the University of the South at the Suwannee Writers Conference, and I can't imagine a much more beautiful place where one can walk and see the buildings. And there's really an atmosphere that I have a car here out of necessity, but it really, you really don't need it.
You really don't need it, and I don't have one, though my husband's coming in a couple days in the car. And it'll be the first time that we will have, that I'll have the experience of driving from the dining hall to Rebel's Rest, where we are now. And I hope I don't succumb to it, but I notice that all the locals have. Pretty much everybody drives, even that little distance to the...
Yeah, so this is kind of a microcosm of the
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
One of the goals of the show was to introduce readers, book clubs, writers, to entertaining novels that are extremely well written, that are accessible, and that if one reads the first book, Le Divorce, I think it's natural to proceed and read the other two, and you're in for quite a time, quite a rollicking time. So one of my goals is to introduce people. Most people, or a lot of people, would be familiar with Les Divorces, the book and the movie. But I think it's an ideal type of novel because the characters' motivations I find just fascinating. And if you would, particularly in L'Affaire, it almost has the feel of almost like a locked room mystery because the characters are kind of set and you kind of understand what's happening. And if we could move to L'Affaire for a moment, you must have had a wonderful time writing that.
I had a wonderful time writing that. It takes place in a ski resort where, in fact, we go skiing every winter, so it's a place I know well. But like, say, the English country house mystery or the locked room mystery, it has a finite number of characters all in one place, the mm-hmm. hotel. And also hotel novels, I've always loved them. So I wanted to do one like that, and it was great fun.
I must say, I find it refreshing in the world we live in, someone that who has the courage to be politically incorrect or or daring in some of the things that they write. And I must admit that I laughed out loud when Amy, one of the characters in L'Affaire, you write, Amy was I'm paraphrasing, Amy was discovering that it was difficult to be rich. And it's so hard to say something like that and to get away with it. And I want to ask you, when you created the character of Amy, and she's a wonderful character, and she, without giving away any of the story, she is very well off, relatively nouveau riche, and she's really struggling with coming into this large amount of money.
How to be virtuous, how to conduct a normal life. I must say, I thought of Amy today because Martha Stewart has just been sentenced. And I have to say I'm on Martha Stewart's side because I think it's so stupid and vindictive of these grandstanding lawyers to prosecute someone like Martha Stewart just because she's a successful woman, when there are all these arch criminals like Ken Lay out there. Just seems, yet again, to put the government in a very bad light.
Yes, the magnitude of the sentence in comparison to what took place in the rest of the world is really...
Exactly. And anyway, I think if somebody called me up and said, I think the FDA is going to dump refuse our whatever it was, I would sell my stock too. I mean, right. Wouldn't you? You're a stockbroker.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that there was a survey done, and they asked people, if you had access to inside information, would you use it? And 75% of the people said they would.
Of course. What are friends for?
Right, right.
So, but
that, Amy probably would not have sold her stock. She might have.
Amy might not have. But she does talk to her financial planner and...
Cigarette,
right, every day, and keeps her eye on the market, absolutely.
Yeah. Amy, she's not obsessed with it.
She's not obsessed with it. Amy got her money through Silicon Valley, like, I must say, a lot of people in my part of California. So it's the sort of person that I've run into.
And she had the good sense to save her money.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people, it would be a completely different novel had she... have stock options and ended up losing.
Right.
There's a lot of more of those people.
Did really happen, yeah.
Yes.
The property values in California fluctuated wildly because there were suddenly so many big mega mansions on the market.
Mm-hmm. You bring up an interesting topic and one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about. And you're listening to the Casey Kohar Show, A Celebration of Words. And please stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Casey Kohar Show, A Celebration of Words. Today's guest is Diane Johnson, and we're discussing L'Affaire, and we're also talking about the conflicts between the French and the Americans, which seems to have intensified. And we were talking about the character of Amy. And one of the things that I find in your novels is, I've heard you referred to as a feminist writer, and as a man, I'm very offended by that when I hear that, because I read your novels, and I find them fascinating. And I think if men would read these novels, they'd find out a lot about women that they probably don't know.
Well, lots of men do read them, I'm happy to say.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm always surprised to hear myself characterized as a feminist. Of course, I am. I mean, any nice woman is a feminist, of course.
But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's kind of like men shouldn't perhaps read Worsley Affair, which I think is absurd.
That's absurd. And I'm happy to say that men are more sensible than that.
Good.
Especially after Le Divorce, where the heroine, Isabel's lover, is a man of 70. I feel I've been told that I have a whole new category of reader, elderly gentlemen who are very pleased to find this characterization of people in their age group as attractive and sexy. So,
good.
Yeah.
Good. Well, I wanted to get that off my chest because I want all the men that are listening to the show to read the three novels, and I think you will. Having been raised by strong women and married to a very successful woman, Tina Rich, I find the characters very believable, and I've learned a lot about women by reading your books, and I don't consider it a gender thing. I think it's just a talent and a style that you have and a gift to portray men and women as equals.
Thank you very much. That's yes, my protagonists are usually women, but I like to feel that I can depict men and go into their heads.
You do a pretty good job. So when Le Divorce had the success that it did, how quickly did you decide to write the second, Le Mariage?
I started it pretty much right after Le Divorce came out, that is to say a year after finishing the divorce. I think they come out at about sort of 2 to 3 year intervals, and that's about the time that it takes to write the next one.
And I will mention that the three novels we're discussing are available, published by Dutton in hardcover, and a wonderful thing that's happened is that Ms. Johnson's most of her, if not all of her works, have been reissued in
attractive
trade paperbacks. If you would just tell me a little bit about that, because one of the brilliant ideas that I'd like to find out whose idea it was, most of the jackets, when you see a Diane Johnson book, you know what you're getting. There's a brand almost, and I find myself kind of having to check the checklist and make sure that I've not read one or something. But there's a similarity to the covers, which makes it very easy for readers to find out. How did that take place?
Well, it took place when I moved from Knopf to Dutton to be with an old friend, William Abrams, who was an editor at Dutton and who alas died. But it was his idea. These Nina Berkson covers were his idea in collaboration with his assistant, Rosemary Ahern, who became the editor for Le Mariage. And in general, the credit goes to Billy Abrams, but also to all the editors at Dutton, because they did then bring out my paperbacks and find this talented artist. And it has been fun to see them all.
Who is the artist?
Her name is Nina Berkson.
Okay. And she does a wonderful job.
Yeah, I've never met her or had any communication with her. But
that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, Nina, if you're listening, send me an email, and maybe we'll talk. I love the dust jackets, just the whole concept of dust jackets. And there's an author, Jim Harrison, who has Russell Chatham paint landscapes on his novels. And I would buy the books for the dust
jackets. For the dust jackets.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the idea of having a sort of signature dust jacket is kind of logical when you think about it, and a help to the browser in a bookstore.
And particularly in the world we live in now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was brilliant. Let's talk for a moment about some of the biographies that you've written. You wrote, which I find totally fascinating, is you wrote The Life of Dashiell Hammett and Lesser Lives, a biography of, I'm sorry, the woman's name?
Mary Ellen Meredith.
Mary Ellen Meredith. And what I find so interesting is that the primary way that I read you is primarily fiction, but here you've done two definitive biographies of much different types of writers. And people. And if you would, let's start with Lesser Lives. And just tell me a bit, if you would, about what drew you to
Muriel, no, yes. this obscure person.
Yes.
When I was in graduate school, I was writing my dissertation on the poetry of George Meredith. Don't ask me why, but anyway. And I was just struck by a passage in a biography of Meredith about his first wife. He was married to the daughter of Thomas F. Peacock. It went something like that. Who, however, ran off with a minor Pre-Raphaelite painter and then, of course, died soon after. As though there were some necessary connection between adultery and death. And that was the end of any mention of the first Mrs. Meredith. So that became the subtitle or the title of my book, The First Mrs. Meredith and Other Lesser Lives. And the idea seems rather obvious now, but at the time there weren't too many like this. The idea that the lesser lives around great figures have their side of the story to tell.
Yes, I read it a while ago, but it's a totally fascinating read.
Well, it turned out to be a fascinating book to write because once I started looking for traces of Mrs. Meredith, I went to England, I poked around, I found myself then learning something about Thomas Love Peacock, who was a friend of Shelley and Byron, and then Mrs. Meredith's first husband, and that's a whole category of wonderful sea captains and inventors of the steamship. And anyway, there were almost an infinite number of lesser lives.
There's quite an excitement, isn't there, when you start stumbling across these connections. And I think that's something that really kind of, once it gets its hooks in you, you almost have no choice. You have to, it's like a mystery. You have to figure out what happened.
And in those days, instead of the net, you had to go to Somerset House and look for wills and testaments. I know. It was so exciting. And eventually I found the people who'd inherited the worldly effects of the lover, the man that Mrs. Meredith ran off with. And I became friends with them, and they let me potter around in their box room. And I did find, finally, very few teeny little letters saved by Henry Wallace.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, it was did you have any difficulty finding a publisher at that time for the biography?
No, not really.
Because you were established at that point in time.
No, I wasn't at all. But because I think this is just my second or third book. I had a couple of novels. But my then agent, Helen Brand, thought of Robert Gottlieb at Knopf and just sent it right to him, and he took it immediately.
Serendipity.
Yeah.
Good. Because sometimes when you're trying to write about someone who has lived a lesser life, quote unquote, you find that in the modern world of publishing, that if they don't think they can sell X number of copies, that they're not interested in.
That's absolutely,
It's kind of sad because a lot of people have these wonderful little gems they've found, and it's so hard to overcome that objection. So, yes, but who's going to read this?
I know. There should almost be a series or a special form of publication for these.
Something like they did along the lines of the Seven Deadly Sins or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we'll start something here. Now let's talk for a moment about Dashiell Hammett and your wonderful biography that you wrote about him.
That was a kind of job that I was approached by Random House. Why me? I'm not sure. Maybe because of Lesser Lives. Jason Epstein and Lillian Hellman, who were friends, and Lillian Hellman was, of course, the longtime companion of Hammett, approached me anyway, and I found the idea interesting because I'd always admired Hammett so much, and I lived in San Francisco where he lived, and he was also born in the same year as my father and had some of the same experiences, First World War and so on, so I thought that was...
Good. Yeah, I got to tie in with San Francisco. That made sense.
Yeah.
And then while I was doing some research, I came across that you wrote, I believe it was an introduction to Raymond Chandler's...
Yes.
An omnibus on Raymond Chandler. And so then I was really fascinated. I was not only did she do Dashiell Hammett in San Francisco, but she's done Raymond Chandler in Los Angeles. How did that...
I think that I was asked to do the Chandler because of the Hammett. Mm-hmm. And I'm great admirers of both those writers.
Yes.
Great stylists, principally.
Yes.
And great... great storytellers, and I'm very interested now in the whole process of storytelling and how.
And you could I think if you put Ross McDonald, Kenneth Millar in there, you probably have the trio of
absolutely.
And that's one thing I'll mention, since Kenneth Millar, Ross McDonald can't speak from the grave, I strongly recommend any of his novels.
He's a
fabulous author. And very close with Eudora Welty.
I didn't know that.
Yes. In fact, Eudora Welty dedicated her book on writing to Ken Millar.
Really?
And Ken Millar dedicated one of his books to Eudora Welty.
That is so surprising. It shouldn't be surprising, because he was a serious writer.
Yeah. And she was a fan of his, and he had read hers, and they exchanged letters.
I see.
And there's actually, I believe, there's a book called Inward Journey that is a series of essays on Ross McDonald's life, and in it he discusses Eudora Welty and the friendship that they developed. It was a correspondence.
Just a correspondence. Did they ever meet?
I don't know. I'm going to have to ask Otto Penzel that the next time I see him. He would know. So, but anyway, your love of mysteries comes through. And really, I mean, it depends on how you define a mystery. And Otto Penzler, who I just mentioned, I believe I'm paraphrasing this, I'll be speaking with him soon. Mystery is something of which a crime or a murder
or a secret
is revealed and discussed. So in that sense, the novels that you write could all be, I mean, they have a mystery element to it.
Well, I think all novels and good stories do have a mystery or a conflict, which it's almost the essence of plot. I'm going to be talking about plot for my craft lecture next week.
Good. Good, yeah, and I hate to see people or books pigeonholed as kind of either it's a novel or a mystery.
Yes, it's very, it's an unnecessary genreization, if that's a word, of...
If it isn't, yeah. Great. Well, it's time to take a break. So you're listening to the Casey Kohar Show, and we'll be right back after a brief break. Welcome back to the Casey Kohar Show, a celebration of words. Our guest today is Ms. Diane Johnson. And one of the topics that the three books that Ms. Johnson has written involves the relationship between the United States and France. And I think perhaps there are a few people who have experienced it in the way that Ms. Johnson has. If you would just tell us about what kind of...
Me and France?
Yeah.
France and I?
Yes.
I have been to France to live for 2 different years when my husband took sabbaticals. My husband is a professor of medicine. And he took some sabbaticals in France to continue working with French researchers who had come to America to work with him. And at the end of that time, he had kind of insinuated himself into French medicine. And when he decided to take a sort of semi-retirement from his job at the University of California, it was because he now could work in Africa with a French organization that had the same interests as him in tuberculosis and AIDS, and the connection between tuberculosis and AIDS. So that's a long explanation for why we are in Paris. People tend to think that, oh, American writer, she wants to be in Paris, it's the great tradition, Hemingway, all that, but that's not it at all. So we went in 95, and we've been there not the whole year, but half or a little more of the year ever since. And therefore, I was there in 2001 on 9/11, for example. And so since then, I've been seeing the deteriorating relationship between France and America, more or less, from being, you know, the standpoint of someone in France, not necessarily from the French point of view, but inevitably more of the French point of view or the European point of view comes through in the papers and in the way things are presented in Paris. So I could say from the French point of view. And from that point of view, of course, it's great mystery what has happened as we see all this ill will boil up in America, which surely can't have just been generated out of a couple of remarks by Jacques Chirac. Must have been lurking for a long time in the American bosom, or, and this is my theory, Americans have some anger, rather unresolved. They don't know what it is or where, you know, what to do with it. And so the clever suggestions by the present administration that they should be mad at France, they've just seized upon it. And it just seems bizarre to me.
It seems almost as if when communism was yeah. fell, that we had to hate somebody.
We had to hate somebody, so let's do the French.
Yeah.
It's completely strange. Since France is our more long-term ally, even than England.
Is there a sense among the French, do you think, that perhaps they were right now? And that?
Well, of course.
Well, they've always thought that they were, but yeah. I mean, now when they read the papers and they see the things, is there a bit of a kind of, we were right all along with the Germans not to involve ourselves?
They have made it a point to not say, I told you so. They've been saying, we're not saying I told you so.
Right. But I told you so.
But of course, they did tell us.
Yes, yes. Has the way people react to you in France changed since the events of 9/11 and the Iraq War, which I don't really like to classify the two together because we don't know if...
When 9/11 happened, the French went out of their way. They're always nice and welcoming, but they went out of their way to do extra things and be, for instance, to offer to put up any Americans who might be stranded when the airplanes, when the American skies were closed.
Listeners, this is not us. This is the, we've done nothing wrong. This is the ambulance service here at Sewanee.
Oh. So after 9/11, they were entirely extra sympathetic to Americans. At the time of the Iraq War, I think all they were really saying was, let's go through the UN. We've been dealing with similar situations in Algeria. We know in North Africa generally, we have much more experience with Islam, if you like, and we can give you the benefit of our experience, which would argue for waiting, going through the UN. I think that was their entire point of view. They would have joined an eventual coalition under the UN sanctions.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear you talk about that because hatred is something which is never good.
No.
Anywhere. And it seems like we have, as a world even, we have to hate something.
And it would be much better to hate something more productive than an old alliance of valuable friends.
Yes. It's almost like when the O.J. Simpson thing happened, there becomes such a preoccupation and talk on the television and the radio about something which is really just beat to death. And at some point in time, let's talk about something else. Let's talk about a solution or how to proceed rather than just isolate each other in hate.
And that does bring up the question about whether it was ever a real hate anyway, or whether it was just a media generated and Bush generated.
Your idea of perhaps in the American bosom this happening is very interesting, and I if you ever write about that, I'd like to know. I really want to thank you for your time today, and it's been a real pleasure to meet you and to discuss your work. And I'm urging everyone to go out and start with Les Divorces, and then you'll see the dust jacket, you'll see the titles, and you will carry around in your purse or wallet or your computer which ones you've read, which ones you haven't read, and you're going to enjoy all of them. So I would like to take just a break here. Chuck, that's my editor. I'm gonna try to figure out how to close this. I might edit what I just said a bit. We've been joined today by Diane Johnson, and what I recommend to all the listeners is pick up A Les Divorces, read that, and then you will proceed on to read Le Mariage, L'Affaire. When you finish those three novels, then you have the opportunity to read the rest of Ms. Johnson's work, which does include biographies, and I'm delighted that they've been reissued, and I urge everyone to enjoy them the way that so many of us have. And I'd like to thank you for being a guest on the Casey Coar Show, A Celebration of Words.
Thank you very much for having me. It was fun.